Welcome to Recover Strong, a show that will transform your recovery from an eating disorder by helping you go from theory to practice to mastery. I'm Jessica Flint, founder of Recovery Warriors, and you are listening to our podcast channel created specifically for you in all the stages and phases of recovery. I want to celebrate you for carving out this special time to learn new skills, tools, and get the inspiration you need to recover strong. Let's get started.
I'm your host, Andrea Wells. And just like you, I understand what it's like to live with an eating disorder and be held back by body image struggles. The recovery journey is ongoing, and we're all in it together as we learn to embrace new behaviors and new thoughts day by day. Join me as I connect with eating disorder experts and thought leaders to give you the tools, resources, and strategies you need to recover strong. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Chucks. He is a London-based medical doctor and eating disorder advocate who recently released the powerful book called Eating Disorders Don't Discriminate: Stories of Illness, Hope, and Recovery from Diverse Voices. And Dr. Chucks is an accomplished physician and advocate who is passionate about eating disorders and mental health. He is the clinical lead for Mind of the Student Charity and co-founder of the UK's first eating disorder conference for medical students called ED/MD. I love that name. He has been voted one of Powerful Media's top 10 Black future leaders, and he's been featured in publications like Men's Health and the BBC. I'm so honored that he is here with us today to discuss his new book and share why breaking down stereotypes and elevating diverse voices helps us all to move forward into a stronger recovery. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chucks.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I'm really glad to get into this with you today. I've watched, like, you know, some interviews that you've done recently, and I'm really moved by your passion for breaking down eating disorder stereotypes. Like, you can just see it in the way that you speak. It's clear that this cause is dear to your heart. So I'm so excited to get into the book and break that down with you. But before we do, I want to get into a little bit more of your background. What inspired you to begin working as a medical doctor with an interest in eating disorders?
So medical doctor was relatively easy. Both my parents are medics. So kind of fell into it somehow. But the eating disorder is one of the very few conditions which is so closely intertwined, physical health, mental health. It's clinically very interesting. You know, some of the, you know, the actual way you treat patients that used to come in. And yeah, so on lots of different levels, I find it really interesting. Also, it's just really like, I feel like it's on point, and I feel like now we talk about our bodies and diet and culture, and it just relates to so many different things. So I feel like it's just so topical and necessary, to be honest. I also was privileged to have some incredible mentors in the space, some real heavy hitters in the whole eating disorder space, and the learning curve was so steep, because here's the thing, during medical school, people learn very little about eating disorders, very, very little. I don't know how it is over in the States, but here in the UK, mental health in general tends to get a very small allocation of the time. And then even within that, then eating disorders gets maybe we got a few hours of eating disorders treatment in the whole 5-6 years.
A few hours? I mean,
tutorial. Yeah, absolutely. No more than that. No more than that.
I knew it wasn't much. I didn't think it was that low.
Yeah, no, very, very low. Unfortunately, some of the things, you know how the human body is very complex. Fortunately, some of the things overlap. So, you know, someone comes in with, I don't know, potassium of like really, really low. A medic will still know how to process that, but not in the context of an eating disorder. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in general, another thing which will be interesting to make comparisons between the UK and the US is nutrition. Medics know very little about nutrition, and anyone who tells you that they know a lot about nutrition has either had a personal sort of interest in it outside of medicine, or maybe they are like, I don't know, have another degree, or maybe they're just not telling the truth.
I don't think that's different here in my limited experience. I told you I live in North Carolina, but I'm from Canada. I moved here a few years ago. So I'm kind of like, I see the system here. I see the system in Canada. I hear from people like you and Cara Lissette. I know you're friends with her. I talked to her recently as well. And I hear stories about the UK system. And I'm like, there's a common thread between all these systems, which is like, yeah, it does seem that the training and knowledge in the medical field about eating disorders is pretty low.
Yes, it's phenomenal considering how many people there are with a diagnosable eating disorder. Or, you know, you have 16.16% of people in the UK would screen positive for an eating disorder. It's staggering.
That's millions of people.
Yes, that is quite literally millions of people. So I think things are changing, but definitely not quickly enough.
Let's dive into your book. Just came out in February. Eating Disorders Don't Discriminate. What can readers expect from this book?
Gosh. So this book, firstly, it's a labor of love. My goodness, it took absolutely ages to come together. You know, you have writers from across the world. The book is a collection of essays from relatively like well-known faces or people who have had some public exposure for in some shape or other. And look, their stories aren't any more important than anyone else, but it was really purely an exposure thing. And we wanted to get as many people hearing these important stories. So we thought, actually, let's get people who have some sort of, or who have had some public facing opportunities in the past. And we got them together and they all have lived experience of an eating disorder. We have the book that's split into five sections. There's OSFED, there's binge eating disorder, bulimia nervosa, anorexia nervosa, and ARFID. And then we have writers in each section. And so myself and Bailey Spin, who I co-edit it with, we write throughout the book in different sections. And then there's also other people who we have like interludes. And so essentially, oh, and also we have academics who are writing in the book as well, or clinicians, I should say. So we have dietitians, nurses, doctors, you know, OTs, art therapists. And then we also have family members who give their insights and friends who give their insights. So Eating Disorders Discriminate is a book which at its very heart is hope. You know, there are some terrific stories of people that have really been in the real depths of an eating disorder and, you know, they've come out the other side. There's some people who actually, you know, they're moving forward. And that's the beauty with it. It's not some sort of, oh yeah, everyone's now eating disorder's gone and everything's great. It's realistic. You know, sometimes these things, the journey takes a bit longer. So that's where people will hopefully find some benefit with the book. You know, it has a really strong theme of hope running through it. It's also very educational. You know, so many medics and clinicians in general, you know, the lay person, you know, who's just reading it, everyone can learn something in this book and or from it. And so, yeah, we hope it does what it was composed to do.
What was it composed to do? What was the inspiration behind the book?
So it was about in 2020, when the pandemic really was hitting hard. I don't know about over there in the US, but my goodness, it was bad here. The numbers of people being admitted into hospital were severe. Anyway, my colleague and I were having a conversation and then we were kind of like, why is it that bearing in mind, I work in an inpatient setting. So as you can imagine, the majority of my patients are anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. We don't tend to see binge eating disorder or, you know, OSFED or ARFID. We don't see so much of that. We were talking to each other and said, why are our patients, they seem to be coming from a similar background, a similar context? Like, what's going on? We knew from research, the very limited research that there is. We knew from research and we also knew from our personal, not actual personal, but we knew of people that were experiencing eating disorders that didn't fall in that cliched narrative of what you have to be to experience an eating disorder. And so as part of that, I set out to compile some stories. You know, you can have, you know, be larger bodied, you can be older, you can be, you know, a person of color, you know, you can have a lower socioeconomic status, you know, so all these kind of stereotypes, we thought, actually, you know what, it's time to dismantle them. So we hope at the end of people reading this and the whole book itself, people be hopefully empowered and, you know, built up with hope, but also that, you know, stigma will just be crushed and all these stereotypes will just be dismantled because they need to be.
What do you think are some of the most like pervasive stereotypes surrounding eating disorders?
Well, one of them is that you have to be white to experience it. I mean, I know a couple of people who had absolutely every reason to think they had an eating disorder. But the only thing that meant that they didn't think they had one was just because they weren't white. And, you know, it's kind of like, actually, you know what? This is just an education thing. This is actually an education. You can't deal with something if you don't know what you're dealing with in the first place. If you haven't put a name on it, you know, how are you going to address it? So the first steps with these people were to actually get educated. Unfortunately, they were, they're fortunately in a state of recovery now. But, you know, fortunately back then, they were able to somehow come across the fact that, yes, they do have an eating disorder. One had bulimia nervosa, one had anorexia nervosa. It was the man, actually, that had the anorexia nervosa. They were able to at least address it through therapy and all sorts. But yeah, I think that's probably the one which I think is so stark to me, that actually someone will have all the symptoms, but just because they think it's a white illness, as it were, you know, they feel like they don't warrant a diagnosis. But then there's the other ones. There's the age, you know, people think it's a young person thing. Then there's the, you know, actually, I'm not wealthy. It's a wealthy person's illness. And all these things, they're just not true.
Yeah. Well, that's why the book's called Eating Disorders Don't Discriminate, right? To really bring that message home.
Exactly. And I must say that the title of the book is meant to be catch your attention, provocative, but it's very important to understand. We go into each eating disorder, so we're explaining, yes, there are certain things which make people more likely to experience one. So I've seen people say, oh, eating disorders don't discriminate. Oh, no, but they do, because certain eating disorders are more likely to, say you have autism, you're more likely to have anorexia, or if you have ADHD, you're more likely to have bulimia. Of course, and the book talks about that. But the whole premise of it doesn't discriminate is that just trying to dismantle those that narrative that actually one person or one type of person can experience one.
And how do you feel, or how does race or gender or culture influence our experience of body and food or living with an eating disorder?
Wow, on so many levels. I think you have the culture within, okay, so culture. There's culture. What is culture? Culture is just a group of people, right? And how they do things. You can get gym culture, you can get lad culture, you can get, you know, culture within friends. I think you get cultures within families, and then within that you then get, let's say, an ethnic culture, so the culture of, let's say, a group of people who are joined by ethnicity. So in my house growing up, and I do mention this in the book, it felt very much, you know, black African in the house, you know, West African to be precise, Nigerian. It felt Nigerian in the house. Food was something which was, there was plenty of. Fortunately, my parents, you know, decent jobs, so they were able to, there was able to be enough growing up. So food wasn't an issue, quite plentiful. In some cultures, not in the one I'm from, but in some cultures, where it's interesting is that they probably come from, so Nigerian culture is, as you know, as or you may not know, the life expectancy in Nigeria is 42.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Incredibly low. Nigeria is by far the most populous country in Africa, probably the most well-known, arguably. You know, one in seven people in the world? No, one in seven black people in the world is Nigerian. You know, it's just on the map. This music, it's Afrobeat, like, it's Nigeria's on the map. But Nigeria's life expectancy is 42. In short, Nigeria has a lot of poverty in it. And a lot of the way we do things is influenced by where we're from. And, you know, our upbringing. So my parents, they came to the UK in 1990 or there or thereabouts. You know, Biafran War, which happened in the 60s, you know, my parents were running away from bombs and there wasn't much food on the table. People rationing, people had to be careful what they ate, how much they ate of it. And things were tough. So they're coming here, good jobs, there's food and plenty around. These things can affect how you relate with food. Waste, you know, or now there's lots of it. Does that mean that you know people go the other way and consume as much as they possibly can because it's now here? You know, people's context can really, and people's culture where they've come from can really influence how they relate with nourishment, food. Culturally, food is at the heart of, and very much similar to here in the UK actually, but very much so in Nigeria, like, it's at the heart of everything that happens. we can't, it's odd if you go to someone's house and aren't given not just a cup of tea like they do here, but like a proper big plate of food, you know, in the Nigerian. And these things are, some cultures, it's encouraged, eat as much as possible. It's a great thing, you're eating in. So this is where culture comes into it. And so then if you're a second generation in the UK and in your house, you have a certain narrative and you're going around, you know, let's say a white British culture, which is very much different, and you're conflicted. Some people are conflicted, you know, body types in certain areas of the world are encouraged and loved. In some other places, they're frowned upon and shunned. So, you know, you have different ways in which people relate with their body, relate with themselves, relate with the food they're eating. It's a good question you ask. It's very complicated. And I don't want to come across as though all Nigerians would have the same mentality, because like I said, my parents are privileged now to be middle class here in decent jobs. They weren't back in Nigeria. You get different struggles. Also, the stress of life, of being an immigrant, is tough. You know, these different things can add different layers onto how people, you know, and then there's a control thing. People may struggle with having getting to grips with that. Or some people's lives can be so chaotic and tough that actually the only thing they can control is their nutrition. And then this is, as we know, eating disorders can often worm their way in when you start to think about control and all the rest of it. So yeah, a complex question, but yeah, it's quite a complex answer, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it is very complex and there's so many variables. And I think you've highlighted a lot of them, even just sharing with your own experience. And thank you for sharing more about your background. I think that brings a lot of insight to some more of the passion behind the book. And I'm curious, when you were sourcing like your different contributors, because there's a, like you said, you have a bunch of people who may, you know, have already been in the public eye sharing their story about recovery. How did you source them and what types of different backgrounds and cultures are these people representing in the book?
Yeah, so this is probably one of the hardest things. So firstly, one of the challenges with having some people who have been in public eye is that they're, and I'm not saying they're the only ones that are busy, but these guys are actually genuinely busy. Like they get so many requests to do so many things. So I'm not going to lie and say I approached everyone that I wanted to and they all said they could write. A few people said they could, but then the whole project was very long and they said yes they could, but by the time it came round to actually making it happen, they had, a couple of them had started writing their own books, and a couple of others had been in a project, some of them were on TV, or you know, like we had some other things that they were doing. So I did have a list of people that I wanted to get on board. Fortunately for me, the vast majority said yes they could do it. They were super excited about the project, because again, just so your listeners are fully aware, this is a completely novel project. There's nothing that exists like this, to be honest. And you know, someone said, oh, are there books similar to this? I was like, literally no, that's why we wrote that's the whole point of bringing it together, because you know, it's such a unique piece, because you have, in answer to your question, you know, we have Hispanic, we have Latin American, you know, you have Black, white, you've got East Asian, you've got, you know, Southeast Asian, you know, a nice mix of, you know, of contributors. Now, there are certain things though that cause additional stress. Like it's all well and good having a Black female in the book, but I know, for example, just because I work in this space, that binge eating in Black females is very much a thing. We could not have this book come together without having a Black female in the binge eating disorder section. We just couldn't. As far as I was concerned, because I guess it was like we conducted the piece along with Bailey Spin. So, but we couldn't have an anorexia nervosa section without someone who was East Asian. I just wasn't prepared to. It's such an issue in those communities. So to bring people together in a collective of a good 30 plus writers and not have one in that section, for me, would have felt not right. So that added another bit of stress, and caused, on top of the deadlines you have from publishers, we wanted to get it out in the same week as Eating Disorders Awareness Week. So we were always like pushed for time and things. So, but it all came together in the end. But we do have a mix of writers.
When it comes to these people sharing their stories from all backgrounds, what do you believe the value is in sharing personal stories about eating disorders and recovery?
So I think there's values for the individual themselves. I think also, I hear it can be quite a cathartic process. But I think the value which Actually, just this morning, I was talking to Diane Buswell. She's a dancer, professional dancer from Australia. Hearing other people's perception of your story, how they've taken it in, and the benefit it's given them. Like, it is beyond belief, really. Because some people, the thing is with eating disorders, you can get so into the, as you fully well know, you can get into it. So you can feel like there's no way out. And often hope isn't going to be carried by the person themselves. It's going to be carried by a loved one. It's going to be carried by a friend. Sometimes it's just not visible. You know, it looks like there's literally no way out. And so this story cuts through. You hear someone else's story, it cuts through. And sometimes people may not listen to, I don't know, the doctor or the family friend. It may take a stranger, or it may take someone who they actually idolize to actually tell them, look, I was in your situation, I made it through. Or, look, I'm in your situation and I haven't made it fully through, but I'm slightly further ahead than you feel like you are now. Yeah, I think the stories are very powerful in providing hope. I think they really, really are. Validating experiences. So, you know, if you're, I don't know, you're a black person in the middle of nowhere and you hear this story, you know, you'd be like, oh, wow, there's another, what? Are you kidding me? There's another black person who's experiencing an eating disorder. I thought it was just me type thing. And that's the funny thing. Everyone thinks it's just them, you know, and eating disorders love isolation. They love secrecy. They absolutely love it. And this is what this book is trying to unpick and undo.
I'm a big feeler. I'm like, you made me cry. I'm crying. I think that is so, like, as I've lived that, like what you're saying, like just to hear someone else say, hey, I've done this too, the validation and the hope together, like, oh my God, I think people underestimate how powerful it is. And that's why, like, you know, I used to listen to this podcast channel when I was in recovery and I felt that hope that you're describing. And I love being in this role now and helping to inspire hope. And you're doing it with your book and like showing people from all backgrounds and really highlighting that, like, hey, no, eating disorders don't discriminate. You are not alone, no matter what your background is. Like, oh my God. I'm crying. I'm a feeler. My listeners know that. It's not the first time I've cried on here.
No, but sometimes in the whole process of writing and editing and this and that, it can feel almost a bit clinical and, you know, but actually you step back and it's like, whoa, this is meaty stuff. This is real life. This is real living. You know, we get stories of people talking about trauma, people talking about motherhood, people talking about race, neurodiversity, you know, there's all sorts that's in the book. And it's just so phenomenal that people feel like they could, you know, contribute to this project and share it. I was so grateful. And I'm sure many thousands that read the book will be grateful as well.
Yeah, you're doing something very important there. And I'm glad that you're able to share this with people who are in recovery. And what advice would you give to someone in recovery who's like listening to these stories, maybe for the first time and realizing like, hey, there are other people like me who don't fit the stereotype, who do have an eating disorder. What advice would you give to them in order to pursue help when they feel like maybe they might not be taken seriously or believed?
Yeah. Well, what I've told some of my patients in the past is, first things first, we need to name it. And I've said this earlier. We just name it first. You have an issue and we have an issue here. It needs to be named. Once it's named, then we can move on. And sometimes that naming is actually quite a hard process because the whole point is, you see, education. Some people don't know, or sometimes someone's not able to name it and it takes family to name it. But someone somewhere needs to name it. What I would recommend for that person is just try your best to be open. It's very hard, but even if there's one random aunt in the middle of nowhere, talk to that aunt. You know, if there's one person that you trust has your best interests at heart, talk to that person. You don't have to talk to your parents or your friends, whoever it happens to be, because then you keep the channel of communication open, which is, as far as I'm concerned, critical, because like I said, an eating disorder tends to operate behind the scenes. And so when you keep those channels open, like it could even be, for example, some people have like traffic light systems where they don't want to talk to anyone, but they on their door they just have a red light, or they put like a red sign which shows that, you know, I'm struggling today, or, you know, they'll put green.
Oh, like people in the inpatient treatment?
I've seen it in inpatient, but even at any setting, you know, your friends, you could even decide, actually, you know what, if I wear this pin on my top. It means I'm, you know, you have to communicate somehow. You have to keep those channels of communication open with the people.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, very, because sometimes people don't want to verbalize it or feel like they're unable to. Channels of communication is open. Also, like, naturally reaching out for help. Charities are available in the UK. You know, US have some good ones as well. Going to see your GP. Again, these things are slightly harder to do. But some people are, you know, and it's not everyone who, some people are motivated to recover. Some people are actually genuinely motivated. And they're in that, you know, that kind of, what's that, stages of, is it change? You know, they're in the, you know, in contemplation stage, and they're actually in the action stage. They're ready, to make change. It's when people are in that phase that actually, yes, contact your GP. Yeah, and I think in the US you call it like family doctor or you know.
Yeah, or like PCP, primary care. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, that primary care. Where it becomes quite frustrating is when people are faced by or faced with, you know, a primary care physician who gets it wrong, you know, gets the whole thing, the whole consultation wrong, says something that's completely inappropriate, tells them they're not sick enough, all these different things, you know, jump on the scales, you know, people say lose weight, all sorts of things that people hear that just sets them back big time. Even though they've come with motivation and come with like a spring in their step, I want to get this set, you know, I want to get on top of this. So yeah, so I'd suggest, you know, keeping the channels of communication open, reaching out if it's charities, if it's a doctor or a clinician, and really don't try, as easy as this is for me to say, but try not to be too disappointed if someone says the wrong thing, because I feel like that's quite natural. It's very easy to be triggered if you have an eating disorder of all kinds. That's why some psychologists, they decide, I'm doing such incredible work, you know, empowering them with skills that, you know what, you're going to go out into the workplace and people may, or you'll go out into, you know, the public space or your family or whatever it is, and people will unintentionally say things that you don't like to hear. That is just a fact. Unfortunately, thus you can't police whatever. And obviously people around you can learn and educate themselves, but they're not always going to get it right. So it's about making that, you know, making those steps as well to try and get yourself to the point where you're at least a bit more able to process that information when it comes your way.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're just saying you got to temper your expectations, because tying back to the beginning of this conversation, doctors are only getting a few hours of training on eating disorders. So know that that's what you're walking into, unfortunately, when you go to see a primary care or GP. And that's good advice there with just kind of, you know, expecting it and work with it as best as you can. So how would you like to see the field of eating disorder treatment evolve in the future? What changes would you like to see?
Well, here in the UK, I think the thing I'd want to see the most is proactive rather than reactive care. It feels like we're constantly firefighting. My goodness. I'm constantly firefighting. I feel like we should get ahead of it. So I'd love the eating disorders kit services to be involved. You know, just be involved with like primary schools and secondary schools and really get stuck in, work with more organizations that, you know, tell people to love themselves as they are at present, to love yourself. And I think that's something that not enough people do, or you know, and we're not teaching that enough. I also think there needs to be a conversation where we need to sit down, get the eating disorders clinicians in one room alongside gastroenterology physicians, alongside diabetologists, so diabetic physicians, alongside people in government, sit down and make some, you know, public health doctors and, you know, people that worked in those spaces as well, and sit down and come up with strategies on how we get people moving their bodies without promoting disordered or dysfunctional ways of being. For example, in the UK, we had calories put on menus, which was actually, you guys, in the US, I think you brought it in maybe a few years ago. Here was just brought out maybe 2 years ago now. I forget, is it 2022? It was absolute disaster. It's not evidenced at all to create any benefit, long-term benefit, and long-term change in behaviours for the wider population. So why is it necessary? And then there's the position of actually telling people that food can be had. People can have food and enjoy it. You know, people food is partly a part of it, is it can be to be enjoyed. And so I think, yeah, I'd want more education, if you like, upstream. And I would want the doctors to be involved with that. I'd want the eating disorders physicians or whoever works in the space to actually be involved in that. But yeah, I don't know how realistic that is. I feel like it's a bit of a dream. Though, if wishes were horses, those would be my wishes anyway.
I mean, that does sound like a dream to have all these different levels of medical providers and government working together and preventing stuff rather than putting out fires. What a dream that would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, the book's a good start. And how can all the listeners find the book and stay in touch with you?
So my socials are at Dr. Chucks or Dr. Chucks underscore. So that's DrChucks. Underscore, and that I'm kind of on X, I'm on Instagram. I think those are the only two I use. And just in general, the book can be found in most, I know in the US, I think you use Barnes and Noble, when you use Amazon, and you use, I don't know which ones, bookshop.org. But yeah, any decent bookstore would, you know, they might not have the copy in physical person, but they'll definitely have it online. So yeah, just find it. Eating disorders don't discriminate. Buy one for you, buy one for your friend, family, library. Buy a couple for your enemy. just get it. We really want to spread this message of hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll put links to the book and your social media in the episode notes for the listener. And just thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Chucks. Thank you for taking the time to share the motivation and inspiration behind the book and all the work that you're doing. It's just, again, your passion and your heart is so evident. And it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, my warrior friend, thank you for having the discipline to listen in. If you found this episode helpful and know somebody in recovery who could benefit from its inspiring message, please share this show with them. It would mean the world to us at Recovery Warriors if we can get our cause out to more people struggling with an eating disorder. So if what you heard today was helpful, share the show with another warrior or anyone on your treatment team. You can do this directly from your podcast player or send them over to recoverywarriors.com. We have a goldmine of free resources there for all stages of recovery. And until the next episode, may compassion light the path you are on and courage keep you on it. You totally got this, warrior.